Thank you very much, and good afternoon and evening, my beloved brethren and sisters in our Lord Jesus Christ. There is no greater mystery than that of life that we have to enjoy. Its perplexities, its changing fortunes, its inevitable destinies remain an enigma that tantalizes the greatest thinkers of history. And yet, you know, very few see the true character of life. Very few understand its complexities. Very few still understand its secrets and see its destiny. And that's why the Almighty has in His wisdom provided us with a book of solutions to the problems of life. The book we have before us, the book of Ecclesiastes. We need to reflect and remember that divine glory comes not from a perception seen by flesh, but that which is seen by the Spirit. I'd like to direct attention to the 25th chapter of the book of Proverbs. And the book that was written by the same author as that of Ecclesiastes, a book in which he sets before us little sayings, little excerpts from his experience. He shows that divine glory comes from a perception of things hidden. He says in verse 2, "It is the glory of God to conceal a thing. It's the honour of kings to search out a matter." Almighty God has always preserved His wisdom, His glory, from the gaze of those who are uncircumcised in heart. God has always remained exclusive to the things of the flesh. In the days of Israel, Moses wore a veil upon his face. When the Master went up with His disciples to the mountain of Transfiguration, they were covered together in a cloud of glory that was only visible to the apostles. When we come before the table of remembrance, as we shall, God willing, tomorrow, it presents the glory of sacrifice and redemption, but few can perceive it. Few can understand its reason and its purpose. That's why the wise man said, "It's the honour of kings to search the matter out." Kings are they who have authority. Kings are they who have the destiny of the future of their nation at their hand. Such a king is the one who wrote the words that we have before us tonight, King Solomon himself. But the word he uses there in verse 2, the word to conceal a thing, to search out a matter, the word search is the Hebrew word katar, C-H-A-Q-A-T-R. And it means to penetrate, to search or examine intently, to gaze at an object very, very carefully so as to determine all its beauty and all its intricate details. So God hides, and kings reveal, find the secret, they discover the secret. God covers, and His people are privileged to open the veil and to peer beyond it. And that's why the King of Jerusalem, in the era of its greatest glory, uncovered wisdom that enables us to see the future. He uncovered the secrets of today and tomorrow in such a way that we can identify ourselves along the pathway of life. And as this great King Solomon, in all his glory, perused and pursued life's experiences, he went along the pathway of circumstance, and he delivered a telling exhortation to his servants who continue life's journey today. So in the book of Ecclesiastes, we have his personal diary. We have his experiences day by day. A careful examination, brethren and sisters and young people, of all the elements of experience. The diary is set out in four sections. The first one will take us to chapters 1 and 2. It's his quest for the greatest good in life by his personal experience. He's going to set his heart and his hand to discover the answers to the questions of his subjects. He's going to lead his kingdom in the wisdom and glory of his God, for which he prayed as a young man. He sought for wisdom that he might properly govern his people, and that was granted to him under the good hand of his God. And now he shares it with you and me. Not that we might remain his subjects, but that we might be elevated to kings and priests as well. For that is the destiny of those who discover the secrets of life, who open the veil and see beyond, who see into the inner sanctuary of the deity himself. So chapters 1 and 2 is the quest for greatest good. When we come to chapters 3 to 5, he will examine life by a general observation of its laws and its circumstances. He pursues the course of nature. He looks at the world around about him. Coming now to chapters 6 to 8, he will reveal the experiences of practical morality, how one conducts oneself in life, what we do, the choices we make, the places we go. He will examine those and show the best way that we might conduct ourselves. And then in the last section, which will take us from chapters 9 to chapter 12, the quest is reviewed and concluded. A summary is given, and the true benefits of wisdom are revealed to us. It's the end of the story. It's the end of this pursuit. And we shall come at last, brethren and sisters, to the grand picture of the objective that is before every king who would sit upon a throne to rule. So when we come to the opening section of this book, to chapter 1, and we remind ourselves that in the great plan of providence, Israel's greatest king, a king of glory, a king of peace, was divinely endowed with an outstanding wisdom. He is therefore a representative of our Lord Jesus Christ, who exceeded the wisdom of Solomon, because he was, of course, the Son of God. And this man, Solomon, was given an opportunity. He was given the ability to research, to engage himself in a search for answers, to find out what life is all about. And in the good hand of our God, he has left on record, inspired by him, this book that we might ponder about and gain some measure of wisdom for ourselves, that we might not fall into the foolishness that we see unfortunately developing in this last age in which we live. But whilst it is a book for kings, it is also a book for brides, because this is essentially a message for the bride of Christ. The writer, Solomon, assumes the voice of an ecclesia. He now writes in this book as a representative of the bride. That's shown to us in the opening words of chapter 1. The words of the preacher. And the word for preacher in the Hebrew is koheleth. K-O-H-E-L-E-T-H, koheleth. It's a word which is a feminine noun. It's a voice of a woman. It's from the root quelel, which is translated in the New Testament as ecclesia, in the Old Testament as ecclesia. It's not translated as ecclesia at all. It is the same word as is translated in the New Testament as ecclesia, quelel. So it's a word which means to call together, ekklesis, called out by invitation, separated from this world, separated from this age, that we might be the expression of the voice of a bride of Christ. And that's the word here, the words of the caller, the words of the calling one, one who calls to assemble together. In fact, the literal Hebrew is, she is calling. And the voice of the ecclesia calls constantly to come together, to open the word, to heed the message of Jerusalem, which is above, which is the mother of us all, because that's the spirit of the truth. And therefore it is the voice of the spirit word of truth, the voice of the bride. It's the spirit of the ecclesia, which is hereby granted divine wisdom and enabled to see the results of life, both that which is done under the sun and that which is beyond. It is interesting to notice that the word under the sun occurs 27 times. All of them are in this book of Ecclesiastes. It speaks of life as we commonly understand it. Life today, life underneath the sun. Because when we go beyond it, brethren and sisters, as we shall in chapter 12 of this book, we shall penetrate the very heavens themselves. We'll see what the picture is for those who ascend to the heavenlies in Christ Jesus. But first, we must understand how we shall deal with the measure of life as it is under the sun, the common everyday circumstances of our lives, our present experience, how to handle situations, how to gain the ability to see beyond the vanity that is seen in the faces of men and women in the streets of this city as in mine. So the ecclesia is the vehicle to work out life's questions. That's why it says she is calling. We work out our destiny today within the environment of the truth, within the environment of the ecclesia. It provides us with a vision that answers the questions to which there seems to be no answer. But they are there. Now, in the use of this word koheleth, Solomon uses a personification. You'll find it in Proverbs chapter 1 and verse 20. A personification by which he identifies himself. So Proverbs chapter 1 and verse 20 is the spirit of the book of Ecclesiastes. Wisdom crieth without. Wisdom uttereth her voice in the streets. She crieth in the chief places of the concourse, in the opening of the gates, in the city. She uttereth her word, saying, how long, ye simple ones? And that's the voice of truth to you and me. How long will we wander in the area of folly? Let's come together. Let's enter into this hall, brethren and sisters. Let's open the word of truth. That's the voice of Koheleth. And you have it again in the 8th chapter of Proverbs and chapter 1. The voice of wisdom personified as a person. Proverbs 8 and verse 1. Doth not wisdom cry, and understanding put forth her voice? Of course it does. It does in the word of truth. It does in the voice of the ecclesia. It does in the medium of our own experience, where we are energized by the spirit word of truth. So when we come to the book of Ecclesiastes now, the words of the Koheleth, the words of the one calling, we will hear the voice of the ecclesia. This seems to me to be the final writings of Solomon. And if so, it presents his mature views upon life's anomalies, his weaknesses, his mistakes, his failures, his waywardness. They are all borne in mind as he wanders through the search for life. They all find their expression in this book. So that finally, when we come to chapter 12, having strayed from the singular dedication of his father, as we know the record tells us, it seems that Solomon returns to make a dramatic summary which concludes his record in Ecclesiastes chapter 12 and at verse 9, when he says, and moreover, because the Koheleth was wise, he still taught the people knowledge, he gave good heed, he sought out and set in order many proverbs. Then the grand concluding words, which may well be a summary of his whole life. Let us hear the conclusion of the whole matter. Verse 13. Fear God, keep his commandments, for this is the whole duty of man. For God shall bring every work into judgment, whether with every secret thing, whether it be good or whether it be evil. And the man who voices this is a man who has experienced both good and evil. A man who rose to the greatest moments of his life, the greatest authority of his kingdom, and the man who grovelled like the prodigal son in the husks of foolishness, as the historical record tells us. And yet at the end he is able to say the conclusion of the matter, there's one singular thing to do, is to keep his commandments, because that will make up a proper man. You can eliminate the word is and the word duty in verse 13. It's in italics, which is the printer's indication that there is no comparable word in the original. It's better without them. This is the whole man. When a person fears God and keeps his commandments, it is the complete man. And as we shall see as we conclude, God willing, this evening, it will be represented in the bride and her bridegroom. The completeness of a union which elevates the work of God with mankind. Now the theme of this book is that our affection is not to be set upon this earth, but we have to seek beyond it. We have to seek the treasure of heaven. And that's why you'll find in the book of Ecclesiastes that constantly there is the phrase, under the heavens or under the sun. He's going to show us what happens there, and he's going to lead us to the environment beyond it. You have it, for example, in 25 times, that phrase. 25 times in the book of Ecclesiastes does he use the phrase under the heaven or under the sun. For example, chapter 1 and verse 13. I gave my heart to seek and search out by wisdom concerning all things that are done under the heaven. And it occurs again in chapter 2 and verse 3. And chapter 3 and verse 1. And scattered throughout the book you have that other phrase, under the sun. Chapter 1 verse 3. What profit is the man of all his labour which he taketh under the sun? So the phrase is dealing with the common issues of life. The day-to-day experiences. The things that are very familiar to us. And that's why 25 times he reminds us that he's talking about that which is a normal experience. And yet there's a problem. There's a problem recognized by Kohelet. The problem is one we read when we looked at verse 11 of chapter 1. The problem is we never learn from the past. We never remember the experiences of those that have gone beyond before us. And that's the sad story of life. The young person who bursts upon life with all the vigor of youth forgets the voice of maturity. We all did. We all have. That's what Solomon says in verse 11. There is no remembrance of former things, neither shall there be any remembrance of those things that are to come with those that shall come after. We don't remember what happened to those that have gone before us. For if we did, we would never have touched the hot stove and burnt our finger when we were younger. Because our parents told us not to. Because they still have the scar when they did it beforehand. So, we never remember. Chapter 2 and verse 16. There is no remembrance of the wise more than that of the fool forever. Seeing that which now is, in the day to come shall all be forgotten. So history is a record of failures. For when you read history, you turn over the pages of an experience when people do whatever they did because others did it before them. So he says, how dieth the wise man? He dies as does the fool. So most people make the same mistakes in life, he said. They go through the same old experiences as those before them. And that's why the value of the Bible reading is so important. Because we go beyond the sun. We go beyond the heaven, brethren and sisters. We become elevated then when we read the Spirit Word. We become different. Because the Spirit Word brings to account former things. It helps us to remember what has happened in the past. It helps us to understand. But that's above the sun. Under the sun, and apart from a constant contact with the voice of the Spirit, people remain in the quandary of the present. And life goes on. and the child is born, and he grows up, and he dies, and another child comes along and replaces him. And so it goes on monotonously under the sun. The most common expression in this whole book is that which you'll find in chapter 1 and verse 2. It occurs 29 times in the book of Ecclesiastes. It's the word vanity. Vanity of vanities, said Koheleth. Vanity of vanities, all is vanity. And he's repeating it so that we might understand right at the beginning of the story of our life. It's vanity, brethren and sisters. And when you go to chapter 12 and at verse 8, there you have it again in the last chapter. Vanity of vanity, says the preacher, all is vanity. It's the bridgehead between the beginning and the end of the book. It starts and finishes with this principle of vanity. And the word really means emptiness. A vacuum. There's nothing there at all. Just turn over to the words of James, the half-brother of the Lord. James, the epistle that is often believed to be the first epistle written of the New Testament. And so James in chapter 4 and at verse 14 says similarly. James 4 and verse 14. Whereas ye know not what shall be on the morrow. We can't examine what is going to happen tomorrow because it hasn't yet occurred. And therefore he said, for what is your life? Have a look at it. Examine it. It's like a vapor. It appears for a little while and then vanishes away. Just like the smoke from the chimney. Just like the breeze that comes and goes. And where has it gone? And where will it come from next? It comes and goes, and there is nothing left of it. That's life, brethren and sisters. That's the vanity of life, which people experience under the sun. So now, Koheleth will undertake an examination. He's going to look at all aspects of society. He's going to investigate the benefit of labor, and he's going to view life from the standpoint of the flesh, from the everyday experiences. He has wisdom, he has possessions, he has pleasure, and he's going to put them all into a potpourri. He's going to try them to the end. He's going to find out where is personal satisfaction in life. What gives us the greatest happiness? What should we seek for? But unfortunately, all will fail to fulfill our greatest need. Because God has put into our heart, into the human heart, he's put a key to our future. Into every human heart, whether they understand it or not, he has put an eternity there. That's what he says in chapter 3 of the book of Ecclesiastes. Eternity is in the human heart. And by that, the wise man means the desire of mankind for a future. And he says that anything less than that is not sufficient to true happiness. Look at it now in chapter 3 and verse 11. God hath made everything appropriate. The word beautiful means appropriate or comely. In his time, in its time. He hath set the world in their heart. And the word world there is the Hebrew word olam, which means the hidden age or eternity, as the Revised Version has it. He's put eternity into men's hearts. Men and women seek for a continuation of life, the elixir of life. Get it in a tablet form if you like. Find it from the chemist shop if you can. Something that can keep us living a little longer. That's eternity. It's bound up in our hearts. That's why people seek to continue longer and longer in life. And therefore he says, man can, so that no man can find out the work that God maketh from the beginning to the end. It's all beyond their understanding. Though the spirit of eternity is there in the heart, he says. So there needs to be designed a cause by which man might seek the greatest good. Have a look at chapter 2 and verse 25. This need is there for man to benefit. Who can eat, he says, chapter 2 and verse 25, who can eat and who else can hasten thereunto more than I, says the wise man. And so he expresses the desire he has to enjoy the greatest good. So that ultimately, through the maze of doubt and perplexity, the searcher will find out the answers. He'll be brought to a time when everything will be put right, as you have it, chapter 3 and verse 17. I said in mine heart, God shall judge the wicked and the righteous, for there is a time for every purpose and for every work. Let's point out that although we may not be able to enjoy every experience, for in the main we have not the same wealth as did this man, we don't have the same opportunity as did Solomon, nor the ability that he had to complete such a search as he engaged himself upon. But in the divine goodness, we have been given this one who has been able to search and explain and record. It's a great privilege to stand with Solomon, the greatest king of all the earth in his day, and perhaps the most magnificent king of all history, if the truth be told. And we can stand with him as he conducts his search. Now, the first one, as we said, was chapters 1 and 2. It's a search by personal experience. He's going to put himself in the case of every one of his subjects. And he's going to bring an internal pressures through his own personal desire. Very interesting to remember that this quest begins as Solomon dwelt in regal splendor. He was a man of peace. He dwelt upon a throne. There were no enemies battering against the walls of his city. He sat where his father sat. The king sat in his house, Yahweh having given him rest round about from all his enemies. It said that of King David. And it was at that time that a test came upon David, and he fell in the matter of Bathsheba. Now the king, Solomon, is at his peak of glory and opportunity. He says in verse 12 of chapter 1, I, the preacher, was king over Israel in Jerusalem. He had already experienced much. And now he records his search for the good in life. He's where his father was. And so he sets it down for posterity. He says this in verse 13 of this same chapter. I gave my heart to seek and to search out by wisdom concerning all things that are done under the heaven. This sore travail hath God given to the sons of men to be exercised therewith. To learn something about it. The problems of life we face, the difficulties of our circumstances, the sad situations that often arise, are that we might be exercised thereby. We are therefore afflicted by them, as you have it in the margin, that we might understand. So he sets these laws down for posterity to learn. He involves himself in a wild, passionate endeavor. Nothing is refused to him. In the personal activities of all kinds, as he sets himself for this quest, where was true happiness to be found? Was it in intense activity? Was it in doing this and that? Rushing in your motor car down here and up there? Is that where you'll find true happiness? Well, first he set his heart to a matter of wisdom. He will go into the library. He will study the books. He will look at the records. It's about wisdom in verse 17. I gave my heart to know wisdom. I'm going to learn something, he said. I'm going to know it. I'm going to read about madness and folly. I'm going to understand. I'm going to set my mind to examine very, very carefully. And he had a brilliant mind.
But it only revealed to him the opposite number. When he studied wisdom, it revealed to him madness and folly. That's what he says. I perceived that this was madness and folly. It was vexation of spirit. The stupid person and the ignorant can't understand their own limitations. But the intelligent man or woman recognizes the presence of grief. The more a person knows, the more a person understands about the sadness of life. Great wisdom makes them aware of things that another may not be able to perceive. So that was not the answer to his question. It was not in discovering knowledge, because when he learned more, he became aware of the madness and folly that is involved in social arrangements. So he gave himself over to other experiences. You have it in chapter 2. There was banqueting and revelry. Verse 6, or verse 4 and 5, architecture and industry. Verses 6 and 7, culture and wealth. He gathered everything around about him. Verses 8, 7 and 8, culture and wealth. Banqueting, revelry, architecture, industry, business, arrangements, culture, wealth, partying. It was all there, brethren and sisters. It was the 20th century, or are we in the 21st? I'm not sure about that. It was the 20th century, all there in his experience. Because nowadays we have the opportunity, perhaps more than in former times, to indulge in all the world offers us. Nothing was held back. You see in verse 11 of chapter 2, nothing was held back, but it didn't produce satisfaction to him. I looked on all the works that my hands had wrought. I looked on all the labor I had labored to do, all the industry, all the poles and gardens, all the big businesses, all the construction work. I indulged myself in all this activity and these arrangements, and behold, it was vanity and vexation of spirit, emptiness. When he built the building, what then? When he planted the garden, what then? When the pool was filled, what then? It became vanity and vexation, and he said, no profit whatever under the sun. So there was nothing there satisfying, nothing complete as far as this is concerned. I suppose sometimes that youthfulness does not always understand the frustration of achievement. The world is the oyster, and it stands out prominently to be discovered. But when we are a little older, then we find out the truth about Solomon's summary. We only need to look at the prominent men of society today, the men who have achieved in their life great wealth. The Rupert Murdochs of this age, the President Clintons of this age, there's no true satisfaction there. They can't earn any. Mr. Murdoch can't earn enough to can't spend as much as he earns each day. And is there a gentleman called Bill Gates somewhere in this world? I mean, he also, what can he do with the wealth he has? And there's no true satisfaction in it. I asked a colleague of mine once why two men in Australia who were very wealthy. Mr. Kerry Packer, he's currently the wealthiest man in Australia. And at that time there was another gentleman by the name of Holmes Court in Perth, who was also wealthy. And they had too much wealth that they could indulge themselves every day and not spend it. And I said to my colleague, why is it that these men continue to burn themselves out in a mad rush to get more money? And he said, it's the $1. The one has greater than the other. The $1. Or in your case, 50p. Or is it now 30p? It's the $1. Because when one man has $1 more than the other, then the other man is set on a course that he's got to get that extra dollar. And so it goes on, and the pendulum swings and swings. And the strivings continue, you see, as people strive to have a fullness, but it's always elusive to them. And it comes the day when the hearse goes down to
towards the cemetery, and the story is ended for them. So you see, nothing in life really gives a final answer to man's needs for which he was created. God put eternity into his heart, and it's elusive. He can't grasp it. He wants it, but he can't get it. So now in chapters 3 to 5, he goes to a general observation. It's now not internal. That is what he wants to do himself. He is going to look at external pressures, the things that are going on around about him, of which he may not have control. And since his personal involvement in activity has not solved the question for him, so Solomon now makes diligent observation about other things. He's curious about the laws and experience that hamper man's happiness. Things that happen, the aspects of life over which he has no control. The laws of the age. You see it in chapter 3 in verse 1 as he commences it. To everything there is a season and a time to every purpose under heaven. A time to be born. We didn't determine that. It was beyond our control. It occurred, but we had no part to play in determining that. And a time to die. In the normal course of events, that also is beyond us. And so he's dealing with certain laws. A time to plant, and a time to pluck up that which is planted. You can't determine either that. Or you can determine when you're going to plant, but it's got to be according to the season. And the season won't change. So you only plant at the certain season, and you pluck the harvest when the season has determined it. So these are laws about which we have no control. We cannot change the sun. Isn't that what we read in Jeremiah today? The challenge of the sun and the moon. You can't alter that. You can't stop the sun from coming up tomorrow. So there are laws beyond man's control. Many things we can't affect. We can't change. We've got to accept them. We've got to work within the perimeters. So if we have a farming activity, then we watch for the season to come around where sowing is appropriate. And some people become frustrated about that. They become frustrated about the limitations, and they struggle against that which they can't change. It's only, of course, when we look beyond the sun that there is answers to the anomalies of life, because beyond the sun is God's wisdom. But the question is often asked us, why all this suffering? Why does a God of love permit the suffering? And the answer can only be seen in the divine perspective. It cannot be seen in human relations. There are no answers there. But in chapter 3 and at verse 22, Koheleth exhorts all to accept the circumstances of life with dignity. This is the voice of the Ecclesia, verse 22 of chapter 3. Wherefore I perceive that there is nothing better than that a man should rejoice in his own works, for that is his portion. And who shall bring him to see what shall be after him? We can't foretell the future. We can't foretell what is going to happen. So we must enjoy it today. We must enjoy our use of our opportunities now. And that's what he's saying. We can't correct the injustices. We can't change the anomalies that exist in life. We must just accept them as they are. And to anguish over future events is to remain in confusion and distress, which is what he says in verse 21. Who knoweth the spirit of man that goeth upwards? The spirit of man always wants to assert itself. It goes up. And who knows the spirit of the beast that goeth downwards? It grovels in the dirt. That's what a beast does. So who knoweth whether the spirit of man goeth upward? What is his destiny? Is it better than the beast? Or are they both the same? An observation shows that death brings them both together.
death ends all for man or for beast. And therefore the question cannot be answered. It can't be answered until we go beyond the sun, until we consider the great hope of divine blessing, which will come in chapter 12. So the question must remain unanswered for the moment. So the quest continues in chapter 4. I returned. That means he set himself again the test. And he considered all the oppressions that are done under the sun. And behold, the tears of such that were oppressed, and they had no comforter. The sadness of life. The oppressors were in power. Those that were afflicted had no comforter. So man's happiness is limited by his own folly. And having established man's happiness depends upon the will of God. So he's governed by laws, but and controlled by that, but there is also other things. There's oppression, he now says in verse 2. There are constant wars. There's terrorism. There's dictators. They all play a part in sorrow. This is an age of greater dictators than ever before, perhaps. But history has revealed that that's the condition of man. He will become a dictator. His spirit is to go upward. He will strive for something, even though it means treading on his fellow. So that's why in verse 2 he says, I praise the dead, which are already dead, more than the living, which are yet alive, because the dead don't understand, nor are they concerned. And those that are alive are under oppression. And furthermore, he says in verse 4 that there's evil and rivalry. Again, I considered all the travail and every right work, that for this a man is envied. Rivalry, envy. It is the very essence of the 20th century's advertising. You've got to have this because Mrs. So-and-so down there's got it. The bigger motor car, we don't buy aeroplanes generally, the biggest motor car, the better motor car, the better house, the better furniture. It's a matter of rivalry. And that's what he says. A man is envied because of his neighbour, but you know that also is vanity and vexation of spirit. What about idleness then? Let's give it a good way. Let's go on the beach, as some do in Australia. And they collect the dog. They sit on the beach with their feet in the water. So the fool foldeth his hands together and eateth his own flesh. He's going to eat himself because there's nothing more for him to do. So he's full of idleness. And then there is the discontent. Verse 6. Better is the handful with quietness than both hands full of problems, both hands full of travail and vexation of spirit, the discontented of life. Or those in verse 7 with avarice. And verse 7 and 8. And those in verse 9 with loneliness. Two are better than one. And those in verse 13 with indifference. Better is a poor and wise child than an old and foolish king, who will no more be admonished. He's indifferent to all the wisdom because he believes he's beyond it. And that there's all these things that are floating around him as he sees mankind involved in this situation. So in chapter 5, he gives advice on the means of overcoming these pressures and seeking for the benefit. And the first he says is go into the house of God. So in verse 1 of chapter 5, keep thy foot, he says, walk wisely, be careful of your conduct, be careful of irreverence. Keep thy foot when thou goest into the house of God, and be more ready to hear than to give the sacrifice of fools. It's very much the spirit of Asaph, of whom you read in Psalm 73, who he looked around him in society and he saw all those that were benefiting from the pleasures of life, and it seems as though they were exceedingly happy. They didn't have any problems. Their bank balances were flourishing. Until he went into the sanctuary of God, it says in Psalm 73, and then he understood their end. And it's only in the sanctuary of God, and that's the voice of the Ecclesia, drawing us to consider the sanctuary of God. What's it going to show? Well, The house of God is the congregation, spoken of in Hebrews chapter 3 and verse 6. Christ is a son over the house of God. So there must be a discipline, he says here. We must measure ourselves from the divine standpoint. This is going to help us. Verse 1, we're told to hear keenly and carefully. We listen. Faith cometh by hearing, and hearing by the word of God. So we come into the house and we look at his word. Verse 2 tells us to speak wisely, that is, to think before speaking. Be not rash with thy mouth. Let not thy heart be hasty to utter anything before God. So when we come into the house of God, it is before God, you see. And what we say to our neighbour is also before God, because it's his house, it's his environment. He is particularly interested in the things of his house, in the things of his people. And so he now comes into this environment. Verse 4 says he must keep his vows because they are based upon the divine covenant of faithfulness. When thou vowest to vow unto God, defer not to pay it. He hath no pleasure in fools. Pay what you have vowed to give. He has no pleasure in fools who say they will do and do not. And finally, in verse 7, he says that we will fear God. He says, in the multitude of dreams and many words, there are also divers vanities, but fear thou God. And so he says that such principles must be applied in areas where they are most needed, the areas of testing. There are two areas of testing. We are tested in two ways, the pressures from without and the pressures from within, from our personal achievement. Now, verse 8, he says, when we are oppressed, remember that God is higher. He needs to be heard. If thou seest the oppression of the poor and violent perverting of judgment and justice in a province, marvel not at the matter. That's going to be a normal condition of things. But he that is higher than the highest in the land regardeth, and there be higher than they. So there are statuses. There are gradations of authority as you come up to the council, and then the government, and then what is that place just around the corner there, the court of justice. So higher and higher one might go, but there is higher than they, and that's the deity himself. So when we are oppressed by whatever circumstance, let us remember that there is one in heaven, God himself, and he needs to be heard. Now in verse 11, when we obtain wealth, when we have internal pressures, when goods are increased, they are increased that eat them. And what good is there to the owner thereof, saving the beholding of them with their eyes? So you see, the goods that you accumulate are used up. And when we therefore obtain wealth, remember they bring their own distress. So the third section is by practical morality. And this will take us to chapters 6 to 8. In which he says that our own actions determine our own joy. We are the masters of our own happiness, brethren and sisters. It doesn't really matter what is our lot in life. We can rejoice. And that's a power we have. And we have it within the house of God. That's why you see chapter 5 is between chapters 1 to 4 and chapter 6. That may not be unusual, but it's very important here in the Ecclesiastes, because the house of God is right in the middle. Now when he comes to chapter 6, he's saying, the poor man can rejoice in his gifts, in the gifts that God gives him equally with the rich. So materialism is not the answer, chapter 6. And he gives two examples to prove the point. He says, he gives an example of a wealthy childless man and a wealthy man with a large family. Let's have a look at the two of them. Verses 1 to 2. There is an evil which I have seen under the sun, and it is common among men. A man to whom God hath given riches and wealth and honour, so that he wanteth nothing for his soul, for all that he desireth, yet God giveth him not power to eat thereof. He doesn't have the ability to enjoy all he has. He's getting old, brethren and sisters. And he's not able to enjoy the things that once he could with all the wealth he has. And a stranger eateth it. A stranger eateth his wealth. This is vanity. It's an evil disease. So he says, wealth doesn't bring happiness unless it's shared. Unless the benefits are enjoyed with others. So wealth alone is merely a possession without use, or a use without joy. Unless we have someone to share it with, as in the Ecclesia. Solomon was an example, isn't he? Did he not receive riches and wealth and honour? But who benefited from it? A stranger, by the name of Rehoboam. For he never was a son of wisdom at all. He never was a son who listened to his father, Rehoboam. Well, what about then the man with the numerous progeny? Well, that brings its own problems, though different circumstances. Verse 3, if a man begat 100 children and lived many years, so that the days of his years be many, and his soul be not filled with good, and also that he have no burial, they've just put him aside somewhere. I say an untimely birth is better than he. He cometh in with vanity, and he departeth in darkness. His name shall be covered with darkness. Verse 6, though he live 1,000 years, twice told, yet hath he seen no good. Do not all go to the one place. You see, his death is unregretted by his children. He has 100 of them, and they have no care for him. He's gotten old. So even long life does not produce true satisfaction when death comes. At the end of the grave, the stillborn baby, the wealthy man with a large family, or the miserable sinner, the miser, they are all there together. So the chapter concludes now with reminding us that the future is unknown because human nature is weak and transient. So verse 12 says, for who knoweth what is good for man in this life, or the days of his vain life which he spendeth as a shadow? Who can tell a man what shall be after him under the sun? A vain life, a shadow, and under the sun. So that's why now, brethren and sisters, as we adjourn for a moment, and we'll come back to chapter 7 when we come gather again together. Koheleth then will call her listeners to consider the better things in life. Chapter 7. The seven better things that are enumerated in the opening words, in the opening verses, verses 1 to 8 of chapter 7. There is a better end to the story.